new Edith Cowan University research has questioned the legality of Russia's decision to label and prosecute foreign fighters that have been enlisted into the Ukrainian International Legion of Territorial Defence, the ILTG, as mercenaries. In June, Russia sentenced in absentia five of these foreign nationals to prison terms of up to 23 years each for joining Ukraine's armed forces. The soldiers from Sweden, Croatia and the UK were tried on allegations of attempting to change the constitutional order of Russia, as well as participating in the war as mercenaries. Now, this classification of soldiers as mercenaries is now in the spotlight, and with ECU Associate Professor Shannon Bosch's most recent research finding that the term mercenary should not be applied to these fighters, challenging the legality of Russia's decision to classify and prosecute these individuals, well, as mercenaries. Professor Bosch joins us now. Good morning, Shannon.
Good morning, Jeff, and good morning to your listeners.
Well, perhaps we could start off with, what is the difference between a mercenary and a combatant?
Well, it's quite a significant difference. Mercenaries have to fulfill quite stringent criteria. They have to fulfill six different criteria, but for the purposes of this particular debate, they have to not be the national or a member of an armed force that is party to the conflict. A combatant, on the other hand, who is authorized by the state to participate in hostilities, has full immunity from prosecution if they fall into enemy hands. So whether you're a mercenary or a combatant has really significant impact on what will happen to you if you fall into enemy hands. And in this particular instance, these individuals were all incorporated into the Ukrainian International Legion, and so they do not fulfill the criteria of a mercenary.
So would you have to be a Ukrainian national to be a combatant, or can you be a foreign individual to be a combatant?
You can, in fact, be a foreign individual. You just have to be incorporated by something more formal recognition and fall under the command of the Ukrainian army. So there have been 20,000 nationals from 52 different states who have fulfilled these requirements and have been fighting as part of the Ukrainian International Legion of Territorial Defense, and that was established in 2015. So this is not something new, and it shouldn't have been the big controversy that it was.
Well, and you're saying tens of thousands there, so it would seem like these individuals, these ones from Sweden, Croatia and the UK, are really just the very teeny top of the iceberg.
Absolutely, and that kind of explains why an example was made of them. At the time, there was a lot of pressure for Ukraine to release a whole lot of prisoners that they had taken, Russian fighters who had committed war crimes whilst in Ukraine and had fallen into Ukrainian hands and had been arrested and were being tried in Ukrainian courts. And there was a lot of pressure from Russia's side to get them released and to create this international incident involving UK citizens, Croatian citizens, Swedish citizens, was what they needed to pressurize Russia into agreeing to a massive prisoner exchange.
But your research is like a massive, uncovering of what's going on over there. It must be very difficult research to enter into, but what is the relevance and the value of this sort of research from all the way over here in Australia?
So Australia, interestingly, warned its nationals that it would be unwise for them to go to Ukraine and to engage in foreign fighting because they were concerned about what would happen if they fell into enemy hands. And so the relevance of this research and the value of it is that it highlights what happens when the procedural processes that should, in fact, happen when one falls into enemy hands are not observed, when prisoner of war rights are denied, where combatant status and immunity from prosecution is denied, and when Russia misclassifies purposefully individuals who should have combatant status as mercenaries. But more than that, it also highlighted the absolute nature of the protections, the humanitarian protections, which should be afforded to anyone, irrespective of how they're classified. And that includes humane treatment, an independent and an impartial trial, a competent legal counsel. We're not even sure that these individuals were given access to lawyers before they were made. We think they were coerced to plead guilty. And literally within 24 hours of their trial, they had been sentenced to death after this sham prosecution before a court in an entity that doesn't even have a history, a judicial system. So there was massive questions around what sort of quality of judges we were looking at, the summary fashion in which these prosecutions happened. Certainly, it doesn't appear that any legal defense was put up to their mercenary status, which was the most obvious way to challenge the prosecution. So it really highlights what can happen when international humanitarian law is not being observed.
But it's being completely ignored, isn't it? I mean, when you look through the things that you highlight, it's an endless shopping list of evil. I mean, how, if you're not being classified correctly, you know, mercenary or combatant, I mean, you're even then getting in front of a judge that, I mean, little is known about them. And like you say, there's no actual defence of these people, and they are resulting in a summary trial. How can Australia use the research to stop this sort of thing happening?
Well, we already know that four Russian military officials, as well as Putin, and an official that is a commissioner for human rights, have already had arrest warrants issued for them by the International Criminal Court. Now, Russia is not party to the International Criminal Court, so nothing that happens on Russian territory to Russian nationals will fall under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. But where Australia comes in is that there is a principle in international law of universal jurisdiction, giving every country, irrespective of whether they're a party to the International Criminal Court, jurisdiction to prosecute the gravest international crimes. And torture and war crimes, like the denial of POW status, is a serious offence which would fall under universal jurisdiction, which would allow, for example, Australia to investigate and to prosecute or to extradite these individuals. And it can, because of the command responsibility, it can be from Putin all the way down to the individuals who sat on those tribunals in the Donetsk People's Republic. And they can actually be tried if they ever set foot on Australian soil. And that is the same for all other states. So it is a way to isolate these individuals, to send out a warning that these actions will not be without consequences, and to deter further incidents where they are being prosecuted with these sorts of sham trials in defiance of international humanitarian law. So although we might feel like our hands are tied, the world is going to become a very small place for these individuals because they won't be able to travel anywhere outside the borders of Russia without potentially facing prosecution, even if the countries that they go to have got nothing to do with the location that the crime was committed. They don't have to be Australian nationals that were tried. It doesn't have to be perpetrated by Australians. But Australian courts would, if they have the universal jurisdiction implemented in national legislation, be able to take steps. And so that is the sort of encouragement that a piece like this would be for policymakers around the world to make sure that their states are implementing the principle of universal jurisdiction within the domestic legislation.
How likely is that to happen, Shannon? Has that sort of prosecution taken place in the past? Yes. Not necessarily here in Australia, but in other locations?
Yes, there's already been quite numerous cases against war criminals that are being prosecuted all over the world. In fact, there are already several states, 11 European states already, who've already put up their hands to say that they intend starting universal jurisdiction investigations of war crimes perpetrated pursuant to the Russian invasion. But there have actually been, it's not uncommon for individuals after a war to seek refugee status elsewhere when they are persona non grata in their own state, and for NGOs and civil rights groups to uncover the fact that despite the fact that they might have gone to a European country and sought refugee or asylum status, they actually uncover the fact that they have been perpetrating war crimes. And that is when the states where they have sought refugee status can take steps to prosecute them for those. And it's happening.
But as you mentioned, the International Criminal Court isn't recognised by Russia. Are there many countries in a similar position to Russia in not recognising the International Court?
So there's already 124 states that are party to the International Criminal Court. 43 of those have already alerted the International Criminal Court that they think the situation in Ukraine triggers the court's jurisdiction. So that's already a positive thing. So although Russia is not party, Ukraine has, in I think it was 2014, lodged two declarations saying to the court, we observe your jurisdiction over crimes that are being perpetrated on Ukraine territory. Now, these individuals, these foreign fighters, fell into enemy hands in Mariupol, which is technically still in Ukraine territory. It falls in a region called the Donetsk People's Republic. It's not recognized by the UN and by many other states. Only Russia has attempted to give this region sort of independent status. So these crimes have happened in Ukraine territory, which means they do fall under the International Criminal Court's jurisdiction. The issue with the criminal court, International Criminal Court, is that they will not try someone in absentia. So they need to get their hands on the individual. And for that, either Russia would have to hand them over, which won't happen until Putin leaves power, or they will have to leave Russia and be arrested or detained or extradited from another territory.
How likely would that be, Shannon? I mean, just, what if Vladimir Putin happened to land at Perth Airport, what would happen?
Well, there would be a red letter notice put out by Interpol pursuant to an arrest warrant. So that's why the arrest warrant is a really significant step, and we shouldn't be disappointed by the fact that, you know, there's an arrest warrant out for Putin, but he's not being arrested. But we've already seen that it has severely altered the way that he moves around the world and where he goes. And where, you know, he was meant to attend a BRICS summit in South Africa and eventually at the last minute had to attend via Zoom, because when he arrived in South Africa, there would have been a legal obligation for South Africa to detain him and hand him over to the International Criminal Court. So it's a naming and a shaming and a political sort of maneuvering that is going on, but it is all part of growing accountability for international crimes of this nature and for the end to impunity for these sorts of crimes.
Well, Professor Washer, thank you so much for joining us this morning on The Record. There's so much more to go into on the mercenary combatant issue, but unfortunately I'm going to have to leave it there for this morning with the hope that Vladimir Putin might travel out here very soon.
Thank you very much, Jeff, and thank you to your listeners. Have a lovely day.
And you as well. That was Associate Professor Shannon Bosch talking to us there about research being done into the criminality of Russia's actions in the Ukraine.